From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. How do all the companies that send you catalogs and junk mail know about you? How do they know your income, your marital status, your children's age? On today's Fresh Air, we find out from journalist Eric Larson. He says direct marketing is so sophisticated, it rivals some intelligence operations. Also, are women morally superior to men? We talked to feminist critic and journalist Katha Pollitt, who deals with that question in her latest essay. World music critic Milo Miles tells us about an English acoustic band that plays reggae. And Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Scent of a Woman, starring Al Pacino. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. At the United Nations, diplomats are continuing to discuss a proposed resolution authorizing enforcement of the so-called no-fly zone over Bosnia. But the United States and its allies still cannot agree on how the operation should work. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
Diplomats said today that Britain, France, and the United States remain at odds over key aspects of the proposed operation, such as the question of how long a warning period should be given to Serbian forces before enforcement begins. They also disagree over how broad a mandate to give countries enforcing the ban, whether they should be allowed to attack air bases on the ground as the U.S. wants, or should be limited to shooting down planes that violate the ban. Although U.S. officials said last weekend they believed a resolution could be approved by the full Security Council this week, diplomats now say that's unlikely. Meanwhile, Secretary General Boutros-Ghali reportedly warned the Council today that enforcing the ban could lead to revenge attacks against UN personnel. He said Canada, which has peacekeeping troops in Bosnia, has expressed concern about the proposed operation. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
The commander of the Yugoslav Federal Army said today that his forces are on alert and will fight any foreign intervention against Serbs in Bosnia. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli has this report from Belgrade.
General Živo Tapanić said threats of foreign military intervention to end the civil war in former Yugoslavia are aimed at the biological annihilation of the Serbs. The statement came amid increased calls by the international community for military action to stop the war in Bosnia. The army chief said he didn't believe the Yugoslav army can stand aside if the biological survival of the Serbian people in Bosnia is jeopardized. General Panic is no relation to Milan Panic, the federal prime minister defeated Sunday by Serbian strongman Slobodan Milosevic, whose name has been cited as a possible war criminal for sponsoring Serb forces in Bosnia. Western diplomats said the general's statements reflected the pro-hardline election outcome and a decision to answer threats with threats. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Belgrade.
An American civilian was killed today in Somalia, and three others were wounded when their vehicle hit a landmine. The man who died was identified only as a civilian worker for the army, who was accompanied by three security men from the State Department. The explosion occurred outside the town of Bardera. The U.S. military says the four were on an advance mission a day before Marines planned to enter the town. President-elect Clinton issued a statement expressing great sadness at the death. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 8 points to close at 3,313.5. Advances edged declines in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The UN General Assembly has unanimously approved a $150 million fund to pay for the world body's increasing role in peacekeeping operations. The fund will be used to speed up the start of UN peacekeeping missions, which are often delayed for months by the cumbersome UN funding process. Of the 26 peacekeeping missions the United Nations has created since 1948, 13 are in progress today. Two Palestinian brothers were killed and at least 12 others injured in clashes with Israeli soldiers in the occupied Gaza Strip today. Palestinians say 40 people were injured. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The worst incident was in Khan Yunis in the southern area of the Gaza Strip, where the two brothers, aged 27 and 30, were killed. Their bodies were taken from the hospital before an autopsy could be done and buried in a large nationalist funeral. Palestinians say the men were sitting next to their home and not participating in a nearby demonstration when the soldiers opened fire. An Israeli army spokesman said the army is investigating the incident. Meanwhile, the foreign ministers of Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and a representative of the Palestinians will meet tomorrow in Egypt. The Palestinians have said they will not return to the Middle East peace talks until Israel allows more than 400 exiled Palestinians to return. Reports from Lebanon say the men who were expelled from Israel last Thursday on suspicion of activism in Islamic fundamentalist organizations are running out of food. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The Philippines' ambassador to Saudi Arabia said today that two Filipinos who were arrested for preaching Christianity there will be deported. The two men were arrested in October for allegedly preaching and trying to build a Christian church. Saudi Arabia is officially a Muslim nation, and Saudi law forbids the open practice of any religion but Islam. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When I picked up my mail yesterday, one big envelope said in big, bold print, "Terry Gross is one of our million-dollar winners." Of course, in smaller print, they made it clear that what they really mean is, if I enter the sweepstakes and if I win, then I'll be a million-dollar winner. Well, why me? How do they get my name? And if I enter the sweepstakes, whose mailing list will I get on next? Well, my guest Eric Larson has the answer to many questions about how direct mail marketing companies get information on our lives. His new book is called The Naked Consumer: How Our Private Lives Become Public Commodities. Larson told me about the suspicious things he received in the mail that set off his investigation.
The first was actually when my first daughter turned one. Within 6 days of that, we got what amounted to as a corporate birthday card. And I thought this was kind of neat because I can't remember the birthdays sometimes of my own kids, I'm ashamed to say, let alone a million other kids. And here was a company that was sending us, to us parents, sending us a note acknowledging that we now had a daughter who had just turned one, how neat that was, and here are 50 offers that you might be interested in. So that was intriguing enough, but what really hooked me was when I had my second child. Within 2 weeks of that, I stepped out my door in San Francisco. We lived there at the time. And there, flapping in the breeze, literally, on my stoop, was a package of diapers. Two Love's diapers, courtesy of Procter & Gamble. And what was so interesting about that is that, first of all, that they arrived. And second, that they had been delivered not by the regular mail, but by some other entity, presumably a newfangled kind of stork, I guess. But it was not the mailman. Then I was really hooked. And until that point, I had already started to see signs of intelligence in my mail. And I'd become really intrigued about how companies knew things like my mortgage balance, and that I had just bought a house, and that my car was about ready to trade in, you know, things like that. So I started looking, and I started trying to trace back my marketing persona through the databases of America.
So one of the things you did was kind of go undercover. What was your undercover hook?
Well, I had a couple of undercover hooks. One was I founded a direct mail company called EL Enterprises. And I did that because I wanted to hear what the marketers and brokers of names were telling each other about the rest of us. And that was really an eye-opener. I found a great reservoir of disdain for the consumer. You know, they refer to us as in many cases, as opportunity seekers, which is an industry euphemism for suckers, and they routinely trade our names and describe us as people who are you know, terrific targets, and we'll go for anything, and we're really voracious consumers, and all that amounts again to being opportunity seekers. You know, you can even be in a database of people who got turned down for credit. That's a very exciting database for some companies because they can pitch you scam credit offers. For example, where you sign over your house in return for a credit card, that kind of thing.
So you founded your own phony direct mail company.
Right.
And then you also...
My favorite part was when I invented a new wife. There is one very large effort afoot right now to find out the names of all the pregnant women in America. I mean, this is of intense interest to companies because pregnant women will eventually become mothers, and mothers are, at least by the marketer's viewpoint, inherently neurotic and therefore susceptible to offers of all kinds, especially first-time mothers. So anyway, I wanted to tap into this, and I invented a new mother named Angela. And to insert her into this database, I called up American Baby Magazine in New York, and I said, with I hope a proud tremor in my voice, I said, look, I'm about to be a father, and I'm very excited, and we want all the information we can, and I'd like to get your magazine, and how do we do that? And the operator said, well, what do you know? We have a special 6-month offer where you can get 6 months free. And I thought, well, that's great. I was delighted. And she said, now, tell me your wife's name. And I did. And she said, and now tell me when your baby is due. And I gave her the due date. And then she said, and is this a first-time baby? And I said, oh, yes. And then I waited. And the due date rolled around. Of course, Angela had her baby, fortunately with no hitches. The labor was remarkably quick, instantaneous, in fact. And suddenly, within 2 weeks of that, came this torrent of mail.
Well, I learned a new word reading your book. I learned several new words, but this new word describes why it is when your daughter was born, you got little gifts from companies in the mail. The word is syncographics, and that's the word that describes how companies know how to sync up their product pitches with important moments of your life.
Right, right. That's the wave of the future. We're just seeing the beginnings of that now. And yes, I mean, this pitching all these offers to new mothers is a prime example of that. Probably my favorite example, though, was a writer friend of mine on his 40th birthday received a letter from a newsletter called Sex Over 40. It arrived on his birthday. And this is not exactly the kind of mail you want to get on your birthday. This letter essentially went on to describe all the sexual dysfunction that one can expect once you turn 40 and later on. So that's the kind of syncographics we might expect to see more of.
So how do they know when you're turning 40? This is because you bought some kind of product in which you told them in a questionnaire how old you were?
No, actually, there are many, many ways that they can find out your age. Probably the primary way is through acquisition of your motor vehicle records, which is very common. Some 35 states routinely sell your motor vehicle and your driver's license records and your registration records. And that, of course, includes birth date.
So in 35 states, if I owned a company, I could buy people's motor vehicle bureau records and use that to market my product?
Exactly, yeah. And it's done. And the states are very obliging about it, too. They will put this information on computer disks and I suppose, CDs and sell it to you at cost. It's a marvelous racket.
Actually, you say the Census Bureau and private industry have worked out some nifty deals. What kind of arrangements have they worked out?
They have in the past. One thing I have to specify, and I always do, is that the Census Bureau does not give out specific names and addresses. That's very clear. They're very good about that. But what's happened is that over the years, Census Bureau information has been essentially co-opted by the marketing establishment. It seems now that really the Census Bureau exists to provide the marketers with information. And there have been some deals, some that were pioneering deals in all this direct mail industry, where companies were given first crack at information or Census Bureau technology well before the public even knew it existed. And in some cases, companies adopted the technology, and the Census Bureau found itself having to buy it back from these companies. It's kind of a curious arrangement.
Let's get back to your subscription to American Baby Magazine. You took that out under the name of your phony wife, Angela, a name you'd made up just so you could track what was coming in under that name.
Right.
And they were able to use this for, quote, syncographics, to have information to give other companies about the fact that you had a pregnant wife. There was a baby on the way. They'd know, you know, the baby's approximate age as the baby grew up, right?
Right.
What do they do with that information? They sell it to other companies?
Yeah, and sell it, trade it, rent it, you name it. The information the information migrates to various databases around the country. There are a lot of data exchange agreements in the works right now. For example, a lot of that information winds up in the Metromail database, Metromail being a gigantic database concern.
So if I'm being interviewed by a market research person, or if I fill out a questionnaire after I buy a product, it's not just for that manufacturer. They're going to perhaps sell that information to other people.
Yeah, depending on the arrangement. For example, if you buy a, say, a TV set, and you check out, you find the warranty card, and you fill out the questionnaire that often accompanies that, that asks you about your personal passions and hobbies and income and so forth, you're not filling that out for warranty purposes. That's necessary to understand that right up front, although I suspect the companies want you to believe that. What happens is that information migrates to databases as well. It is actively collected and sold to other companies who want to get a richer sense of who you are.
You know, a piece of junk mail that most of us end up getting is the Publisher's Clearinghouse sweepstakes. That's the Ed McMahon, you may already be a winner mailing.
Right.
And you say that this is not just, you know, the way of getting business for Publishers Clearinghouse, that it's an intelligence feeler. What is it designed to spot?
Well, now, we have to be a little careful about that one, because it is an intelligence feeler for Publishers Clearinghouse. They assure me that they do not rent names to others.
I see.
But the point is that we encounter these intelligence feelers all the time. And the reason that is an intelligence feeler for Publishers Clearinghouse is that when you respond, you tell Publishers Clearinghouse something very important about you. You tell them that you're a responder, you know, which is, it may seem obvious, but it's very important for companies to know that. And depending on how far you go with the gimmicks and so forth, they get an even better sense of, you know, when I say the gimmicks, the various things you have to do with the envelope before you can send it back. I mean, they really put you through hoops now with all the stickers and all that stuff you gotta stick on there. They get a real indication of how enthusiastic you are about mail order stuff and about how far they can go with you. Other companies do the same kind of thing, say you'll get you may get an offer for a real sleazy product, say like a 35 millimeter camera for $10.99. And if you order that product, first of all, you may or may not get the camera. You may get a real sleazy, cheap little camera. Most important is you have betrayed yourself to be, as I referred before, an opportunity seeker, a sucker. And they love these sucker lists.
So what are you likely to get if you end up on a sucker list?
Well, once you're on a sucker list, you're going to get a lot more offers like that. You're going to get a lot of offers for free vacations, you know, where you have to go to some condo timeshare resort. And once you get there, you realize that nothing in life is free, that you are subjected to a massive sales pitch while you're there. You may get offers, the oldest scam on the books, you know, waterfront property in Oklahoma. I mean, that kind of thing. Once you're on a sucker list, you can expect an awful lot of interesting stuff to arrive at your house.
Let's get back to your real baby, not the baby of the wife that you made up just
right.
To track, just to track junk mail. When your baby was about to be 1 year old, she got a little gift in the mail. Now, how did they know that your baby was going to be one?
How'd they know?
Yeah, what had you bought that gave that information?
I think where that came from, and it's the most common source of intelligence about who's pregnant and who's not,
mm-hmm.
where we betrayed that fact, and where a lot of women do so, and men, of course, is in the birth education classes that they attend at hospitals and elsewhere now. Often the instructors... always the instructors take down the names and addresses and due dates. But what was not terribly well known is that they also pass them along to other companies like Metromail and so forth.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Larson. He's the author of the new book, The Naked Consumer, How Our Private Lives Become Public Commodities. And we're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Eric Larson, author of the new book, The Naked Consumer, How Our Private Lives Become Public Commodities. In many places now, when you're at the checkout line, you have one of those scanners. So instead of the cashier looking at the price, they just run the product over, I guess, a little laser beam or something. And
right.
it just automatically registers what the item is and what the price is. I didn't realize until I read your book that that is also another intelligence network.
Yeah, that's evolving now as another hot new territory for this mass surveillance, as I like to refer to it. The important thing to remember is it's not the scanner itself that does it. I mean, the scanner is not looking up out of that little glass plate and identifying you. What happens is companies have now begun, grocery stores have now begun what are referred to as frequent shopper programs, where they lure you with special discounts and this whole sort of clubby thing to fill out a fairly detailed demographic application, in return for which you get a plastic identification card, perhaps with a barcode or a magnetic tape, very much like an ATM machine card. And so now, if you are a member, you step up to the checkout counter, and for the first time in the history of modern supermarkets, a truly unprecedented thing has occurred. They can at last link you specifically to your products, and not just that day, but throughout your purchasing history at that store. So you say, well, geez, you know, so what? I'm getting discounts, and they're getting information. The problem is products in grocery stores tell an awful lot about us now. Think about it. If you buy Preparation H, a company now can know that you have hemorrhoids and maybe run with that. You know, you can imagine the kinds of things that you might get, you know, scam cures and so forth. Let's say you buy, you're a prolific user of condoms and you buy them at the grocery store. Suddenly, a company somewhere has a real powerful sense of your sex life. And I'm not sure that people are aware that that kind of thing can happen.
So the more new technology we get, the more options there are for marketers to get information about us.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Now, one thing I have to stress is that, you know, there is a tendency to dwell on the paranoid aspects of all this, that this is, you know, Orwell, and this is 1984. My true mission here is to have kind of even the playing field and just show people how companies collect this information. I mean, on one hand, it's a great technology story. It's also a terrific bit of commercial Americana. I've been fascinated for a long time with corporate excess, how companies get obsessed with collecting things and doing things. And this is one of those grand corporate obsessions to find out about American consumers. It's a terrific, terrific story on a lot of levels. And so I don't really want people to go out screaming to their grocery stores and say, my Lord, you know, I didn't know you were collecting this stuff and start burning down grocery stores. That's not the point. The key thing is to know what's going on, know how the information migrates, and then evaluate, is this a good thing or a bad thing? You can't evaluate until you know.
A lot of what you found is pretty amusing and just, you know, interesting to know about. Of everything that you learned, what strikes you as potentially dangerous?
Well, I would say that a lot of it is potentially dangerous. In fact, all of it is potentially dangerous. But you have to be careful when I say that. I mean that in America, we have in the past been at times in our nation's history very willing to sacrifice the civil rights of our peers. And often what is the most coveted commodity at those times is a list of names. For example, I cite after the invasion of Pearl Harbor, we were very quick to intern the Japanese on the West Coast. During the McCarthy era, lists, you know, people were brought before the Senate subcommittee to name names. That was the key, was naming names. And you think about some of those situations and you extrapolate to if those situations occurred now. You know, the technology exists, frankly, for a Senate subcommittee to go to one of the giant databases and say, look, we know that your typical card-carrying communist or Islamic fundamentalist or pick the group you want to target has these characteristics, shops at these stores, and has done this and this and this. Please print out a list for us of everybody who fits that profile. And then they can have a huge list that while it may not be concrete and in and of itself totally accurate, could lead investigators to various people's doors without any real justification. Lists are just very, very powerful things to have, and nobody gave these companies the right to collect them, and we have no say over how they're policed, and that's always troubling.
So you see this almost as a commercial intelligence network.
Oh, very much. It is a commercial intelligence network, and it's on a far vaster scale than I think anybody really appreciates. I think it's a far more effective and vaster intelligence network than anything the CIA or FBI came up with when they were spying on domestic protest groups.
Do you think there should be controls over it?
Well, now we get into a real, real tricky area. I think what we need is controls that help us. Well, that help us, frankly, control the fate of our own information, and that help us keep certain bodies of information segregated from others. For example, there should be a Chinese wall between federal records and documents and about us and private databases. The trouble is, even that wall, which once existed, has begun to come down. Notably, in the way that the federal government will tap, has enlisted the aid of private credit bureaus now to track down, for example, deadbeat fathers and also anybody who has an outstanding personal debt to the federal government. Which, that was an unprecedented change, which occurred in the early 80s without much attention, but it's a very significant one. It's for the first time a merger of those two bodies of information. So control of information is for the rest of us is very important. How do we do that? I have some ideas. Mostly, I think what we need to do is we really need to have a real full-bodied debate to consider the technologies that exist today, and to say and to paint some scenarios and say, well, how are we going to control this? How are we going to avoid this?
Now that you have all this information about marketing, do you wish you could use any of it to sell your book?
Well, interesting question. I had actually had this tantalizing thought, and I kind of suggested it tongue in cheek to my editor that we send to all the important book reviewers a special direct mailing telling them exactly how much they weighed and what their driver's records were and so forth. That didn't go over very well, but mostly I think because of the cost. it's a powerful kind of database out there to use. But I would have been real concerned about using direct mail, frankly, to really alienate my audience.
Eric Larson, thank you very much, and happy shopping.
Oh, thank you, and Merry Christmas.
Have fun with your mail.
Thank you.
Eric Larson is the author of The Naked Consumer, How Our Private Lives Become Public Commodities. He's also a feature writer for The Wall Street Journal. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When feminist writer and critic Katha Pollitt was invited to sign a women's peace petition, she hesitated. It's not that she isn't for peace, but the petition was based on the assumption that as mothers, women had a special interest in preserving human life. Coming up, we talk with Katha Pollitt about her answer to the question that is the title of her latest article, Are Women Morally Superior to Men? And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie, Scent of a Woman. Al Pacino stars as a blind colonel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. The U.S. force in Somalia has suffered its first death. A civilian was killed today when the vehicle he was riding in drove over a landmine near the town of Bardera. Three State Department security men traveling with him were injured. Tom Carver filed this report for the BBC.
The small unit of Americans was in Bardera to prepare the way for the arrival of the convoy. The town itself is little more than a collection of broken houses and mud and reed huts, destroyed by years of fighting and famine. One aid worker who saw the American vehicle hit the landmine said it was traveling across a region close to the dirt airstrip, which is littered with mines. We saw no evidence of the army when we arrived in the town, except for several helicopters circling slowly overhead. Robert Oakley, the U.S. Special Envoy, arrived here today to talk to the local warlord, who is an ally of the notorious General Morgan, the son-in-law of Somalia's former ruler, Siad Barre. The main American and French force is expected to arrive in the town by tomorrow night, having cleared a route through the mines.
Tom Carver reporting from Bardera. Masked attackers killed two Palestinian men in Israeli-occupied territories on Wednesday. The two men had been accused of collaborating with Israeli authorities. The Palestine Liberation Organization group Fatah claimed responsibility for at least one of the killings. President-elect Bill Clinton is still reviewing choices for his final four cabinet appointments. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Clinton had hoped to have his entire cabinet announced by Christmas, but his effort to maintain racial and gender diversity may be slowing down the process. Clinton still must name the secretaries of Agriculture, Interior, Transportation, and Attorney General, as well as the United States Trade Representative. Former Arizona Governor Bruce Babbitt, long reported to be Clinton's top choice for Interior, was in Little Rock today. He is the preferred choice of several environmental groups, but Hispanic groups are concerned that only one Hispanic, HUD Secretary-designate Henry Cisneros, has been named so far. And recently, New Mexico Representative Bill Richardson, who is of Hispanic descent, has reemerged as a likely Interior appointee. Babbitt is now considered the top choice for USTR. Today, George Stephanopoulos, Clinton's communications director, said resolving the goals of diversity and excellence isn't always easy. In Little Rock, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Commerce Department reported today that orders for durable goods fell 1.9% in November. Commerce officials say the drop was caused by a huge decline in orders in the aircraft industry. Durable goods are those products such as cars and computers that are expected to last more than 3 years. The Commerce Department says the orders totaled a seasonally adjusted $123 billion. That's down $2.5 billion from October. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed mixed today, losing nearly 8 points to finish up at 3313.54. This is NPR News. A jury in Houston said today that a Texas woman should get $25 million for a silicone breast implant that ruptured. Pamela Jean Johnson has sued the implant maker, Medical Engineering Corporation, and its parent company for $64 million. She claimed that they produced and marketed implants which they knew were either defective or insufficiently tested. Johnson says she contracted an autoimmune disease from the rupture. A federal judge in New Orleans has ruled Louisiana must merge its racially segregated university system. Jim Engster reports.
Judge Charles Schwartz is giving the state 60 days to disband and consolidate Louisiana's four higher education boards, which include separate panels for LSU and Southern University, the nation's largest predominantly black university. Schwartz says in his ruling the old doctrine of separate but equal is an outdated notion that America no longer tolerates. Southern and Grambling State University object to merging into a single system, contending the desegregation order could destroy the historically black schools of higher education. The judge did rescind a previous order for LSU and Southern University law schools to merge, saying those schools have made strides to integrate their student bodies. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Inkster in Baton Rouge.
A district judge today ordered three white Detroit police officers to stand trial in the fatal beating of a black motorist. Judge Alex Allen ordered two of the men to be tried on second-degree murder charges, while the third officer will stand trial on a charge of assault with intent to commit great bodily harm. However, felony charges against the black police sergeant who was accused of allowing the beating to take place were dropped. Last month's beating death raised tensions in Detroit because the three officers accused of the beating are white, while the man who died was black. President Bush headed to Camp David today to spend his last Christmas holiday there as president. Before leaving the White House, Mr. Bush offered holiday greetings to his staff, as well as to President-elect Bill Clinton. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Critic Milo Miles has come across a small landmark in world music, an English acoustic band that's as comfortable with reggae as it is with country and folk music.
Well, she buys a ticket every night. She tosses and turns. First few hours above the dawn are just another stop for this train that she's on.
If you listen to enough bands, ever so often you run across a group with no clear counterparts who nevertheless run like a digital clock and who make minimal fuss about their originality. Such are the Fellow Travelers. They have released two albums, No Easy Way and the new Just a Visitor. They play some fiddle-based country tunes and some British balladry, big deal. The new twist is that they play reggae and reggae dub every bit as casually and comfortably as their other styles, and they see no need to write pseudo-Jamaican songs when they do it.
Yeah, she's the only right around this train.
Because the Fellow Travelers' American label is based in Ohio, I was initially hoping they were Midwesterners. However, the closest they come is that songwriter, singer, and guitarist Jeb Nichols is from Texas. And for the last 15 years, he's lived in England, where assimilating exotic pop modes is a way of life. Even so, it's hard to believe a non-Britisher could write a winsome, class-bound lament like A Few Good Times.
When he comes home from work, it's Friday night. He's had a bad day. He's had a bad week. And he's feeling a little bit low. He's sitting on the sofa with his girlfriend and they're watching TV. She says, "What's the matter?" And he says, "Well, I just had a bad day." And she says, "No, really, what's the matter?" And he says, "Well, I would not mind a few good times. Said I would not mind a few good times in my life, yeah, in my life." And she says, "And what about last night when we walked out together? We both looked at the sky and the night went on forever. And you held my hand, it must have been an hour or two. But what about a good time for you?" And he says,
Aside from Nichols, the principal travelers are simply bassist and keyboardist Martin Harrison and singer Lorraine Morley. It must be said, though, that the bumptious trombone of Boney MC and the spacey, mournful harmonica of Miguel Orgel give Just a Visitor a more well-fed ensemble sound.
Now I find it hard to say what I want to say. What about Texas? I think you know what I mean. It's just you give me such a lonely feeling. And everything you got, hell, I've already seen. So it's goodbye to you, Southern Democrats. And it's goodbye to the Astrodome. For that talk.
As befits an outfit that likes spare instrumentation, the everyday rules in the fellow travelers' songs, and they never misplace a detail. Young love is fading, but slowly. Alienation is rising, but gradually. With an outlook that's never too folky wholesome and never too punky cynical, the fellow travelers win through oblique moderation. Nichols should never do another Bob Wills imitation, and he should rein in the heavy nasality of his voice and maybe give more room to Lorraine Morley. Other than that, the fellow travelers can skank on until the cows come home.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Cambridge. The fellow travelers' albums are on Okra Records. This is Fresh Air. Are women morally superior to men? Are they better at caring, sharing, nurturing? Do women, by virtue of their gender, bring moral values into politics? And is it feminist or is it sexist to think that they do? My guest, Katha Pollitt, writes about this in the current issue of The Nation. Pollitt is a feminist essayist and a poet. She's a regular contributor to The Nation and has also written for Mother Jones and The New York Times. All these questions came up for Pollitt when she was asked to sign a petition a few years ago.
I received in the mail a letter from an acquaintance who was the wife of a well-known writer, in which she invited me to sign a petition that was to be signed by women only, saying, you know, we women, the mothers, the caretakers, the nurturers, you know, petition the powers that be to end war. to end war, to resist Cold War jingoistic rhetoric, and to use the military budget for beneficial social purposes. And it was a conflict for me. What difference does it make if you're a caregiver, a nurturer, a mother when it comes to some issue that affects the whole human race? I didn't have any children. And that got me thinking, too, because I thought, now, am I being given credit for potential maternity, you know? Or is it that, well, you're not a mother, but we're going to overlook this as long as you kind of admit the moral supremacy of those of us who are? And the more I thought about it, the sort of the confusion between the category mother and the category woman, the way that this issue of immense importance to the entire human race had was turned into the particular moral responsibility of half of it, the less I found myself able to have anything to do with this petition. And then, in my irritating way, I spent hours writing a letter explaining this to this poor woman. And in the end, I decided not to mail it, and I simply let the whole thing slide. And I'm glad I did that.
Well, you say that this whole idea of, you know, women uniting for peace, women having a special affinity for issues pertaining to peace, is like the leftist version of family values.
Well, yes. In my piece, I do say that not just the connection of women with peacefulness, but also with kind of kinder, gentler values in general, with being compassionate, with being having what Carol Gilligan calls an ethic of caring. I see that, like right-wing family values, quote-unquote, as both coming out of the Victorian notion of the separate spheres, in which this is an idea that we think of as old as time, but it really isn't. It's really a 19th century idea that came in with industrialism. Many women in the Victorian era who wanted to have some kind of impact politically and in the public world were able to use this separate spheres ideology to get a place from which to speak. They could say, all right, you know, the family is our concern, but look at society. You can't raise a family in a society like this. Therefore, I have to go out and fight for the vote, for example. This was a very powerful argument in favor of the vote, was that women were more moral than men. And therefore, giving women the vote would improve government. Women were able to use this ideology to gain a place for themselves in public life up to a certain point. But it was quite limited because you could only gain that place in public life to the extent that you could connect it in some way to your domestic virtue.
You said that although difference feminism is couched in the language of praise about how caring and nurturing and so on women are, that it's actually demeaning to women. How do you find it demeaning to women? And maybe you could connect that to the petition that you decided not to sign.
Well, I think it's demeaning to people to say, you get your rights in this society and you get listened to in the society to the extent that you are virtuous, angelic, pure, and better. Because most people aren't very virtuous, angelic, pure, or good. And it becomes a way of, it's really saying you're not human. You have to be better than that. I mean, imagine if any other sort of excluded or minimized group had to make its claim on the basis of being extra good. They wouldn't do it. Only women fall for this kind of thing.
Being a mother now, you're raising a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Have you driven yourself crazy at all in trying to prevent your daughter from falling into stereotype behavior? Have you been nervous about her playing with dolls or anything? Do you know?
Well,
like, oh, I should give her a fire truck instead.
Well, you know, I don't see what's so great about fire trucks. I mean, you know, men aren't so great. They spent their childhood playing with fire trucks, and look at them, you know? I mean, I think that it's interesting that when people sort of talk about gender stereotyping among children, the examples they always go to are the things that the girls do, as though that's automatically bad. And it would be better if the girl played with the boy's toy. I think it's, you know, it's good to talk about the ways at which it might be better if the boy played with the girl's stereotypical toy. But I would say, you know, Barbie was hard for me. I hate Barbie. And I hate her because I think she really is connected, along with all the... It's not just one thing, but I think she's really part of the package that gives girls terrible, terrible ideas about their bodies. And so Sophie wanted a Barbie, and she kept asking me for one. And finally I said, you know, Sophie, I have to say, you know, it really bothers me that Barbie, you know, her legs are much longer than a real woman could have. And look, you know, her breasts are so big and pointy, and her neck, you know, couldn't possibly be the neck of a real person. And I thought I was being sort of... presenting it in a not ideological but just sort of realistic kind of way. And then she brought up Barbie again, and I said, well, remember how we were talking about Barbie? And she said, yeah, you said you didn't like her legs. You know, and I realized, you know, she's 4 years old. This whole thing is, you know, went completely by her. All she thought was, well, stuffed animals.
Are there other things that you've really wanted to resist? You know, popular gifts or cultural items or games or whatever that really kind of for social or political or feminist reasons really bug you, but your daughter really wants them and you don't know what to do?
Well, the Berenstain Bears are something like that. She's too young for board games still. She doesn't understand that you don't always get to win. But the Berenstain Bears, which is a very popular series of children's books, I find disturbing because it's a completely 1950s family in which it's mother bear, father bear, sister bear, and brother bear. Everyone is completely defined by their role in the family, of course. And mother bear takes care of everybody. She's always right. She's the sort of heavy. She's the kind of the family nurse, policeman, minister. It's mother knows best. Dad is a total jerk and a goof off. And everything about it is, it's not just its retrograde family politics. It's also just everything about it is on the sort of the minimal level of imagination and drawing level and language level. Now, Sophie adores these books. Kids love things that are in a series where they get to collect them all, and there is an infinite supply of Berenstain Bear books. And each one deals with a little problem in a child in one of the children's lives. For example, Mama's new job. She starts a quilt shop. And the kids are worried that she won't be there to cook for them. She adores these books, and so I get them for her. I just think, you know, you can't say on the one hand, darling, I want you to be an individual when you grow up, and then deny them their individuality, you know? I mean, I read the books I want to read, and my parents always let me read comic books, which were the big supposed destroyer of youth in the 50s. And they always let me have them. They thought, well, at least she's reading, you know? And I sort of feel that way about Sophie and the Berenstain Bears. I hate them, but she loves them. And so she's interested in books. And we can talk about some of the ideas that are expressed in them, although she's not too interested in that discussion, I have to say.
Writer Katha Pollitt, her article, Are Women Morally Superior to Men?, is in the current issue of The Nation. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel of All Things Considered. Later on today's program, we'll hear a special report by Noah Adams about how a food bank works in the state of West Virginia and how it gets food from places like Chicago delivered to people who need it in a place like a small mining community, Cedar Grove, West Virginia. We'll also have the latest news from Somalia and a talk with a spokesperson for CARE, the relief agency there, and news from Silvia Pajoli in Belgrade about all the war talk in the capital of the former Yugoslavia. So much talk nowadays of possible steps being taken against the Serbs. It all has people there quite excited about the prospect of a broader war. That's coming up later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Director Martin Brest hit the big time in 1984 with Beverly Hills Cop, but he hasn't made a movie since Midnight Run, and that was 4 years ago. Now with his new movie, he steps away from the action comedy genre that made him famous. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Scent of a Woman.
The second thing you notice about Scent of a Woman is that it has a screenplay. I mean a real screenplay, full of pungent language. A screenplay that makes its characters at once larger than life and perfectly believable. The script is by Bo Goldman, who wrote some of the best movies of the 80s, including Melvin and Howard and Shoot the Moon. Then he went into Eclipse. It's a pleasure to have him back. Oh, and the first thing you notice about Scent of a Woman is someone else who's been back lately in full force, Al Pacino. He plays Lieutenant Colonel Frank Slade, a blind recluse who spends his days in a shack behind his relative's house, mostly drinking and yelling at anyone who dares come near. The relatives are going away for the Thanksgiving weekend, and they need someone to take care of Colonel Slade. So they hire an impoverished scholarship student at the nearby posh prep school. His name is Charlie Sims, and he's played very well by Chris O'Donnell. What Charlie doesn't know is that Slade has big plans for this weekend. He's going to New York, where he intends to wine and dine till the wee hours and hire the best call girl in town, and then do something terrible. Charlie hasn't bargained on any of this, and he hasn't bargained on the constant torrent of abuse Slade subjects him to either. But once on the plane, the blind man shows Charlie a different side, especially when he talks about his favorite subject.
Women. What could you say? Hair. They say the hair is everything, you know. Have you ever buried your nose in a mountain of curls? Just wanted to go to sleep forever. Or lips. And when they touched yours were like that first swallow of wine after you just crossed the desert.
I guess you really like women.
Above all things. A very, very distant second is a Ferrari.
Scent of a Woman is, of course, a buddy movie and a road movie and a coming-of-age movie. It's like Rain Man, only the handicapped person here has a lot more on the ball than Dustin Hoffman's Raymond did. The adventures that Slade and Charlie have in New York are deftly directed. There's an especially enchanting tango scene, and a painful, brilliantly staged confrontation between Slade and his brother's family over Thanksgiving dinner. What mars the movie, though, is the subplot. It seems Charlie has witnessed some of the rich kids at school pulling a prank on the headmaster, and now the headmaster has given him a choice. Either he snitches, or he loses his scholarship to Harvard. We know that what Charlie learns from being with Slade will help him make his decision, and we know that in the end Slade will save the day. In short, we know too much. But if the movie falls apart in its final third, it's a lot of fun before that. And most of the fun comes from Pacino. He pulls out stops here you've never seen him pull before, wheedling like Peter Lorre, huffing like Mae West, blustering and fuming like Huey Long, ranting like the grandstanding bank robber he played in Dog Day Afternoon. He brings an overwhelming amount of technique to this portrayal, and yet it never feels actorish or show-offy. Everything he does is in the service of character revelation. Some will call it hammy or over the top, but in my book, anything that gives this much pleasure to an audience with this much skill and insight and artistry has to be the best performance by an actor this year.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Voblaitis, and Ron Barron. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, offbeat Christmas music with rock musician and record producer Ben Vaughn and Carl Finch of Brave Combo. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Who's got a beard that's long and white?
Who's got a beard that's long and white?
Who comes around on a special night?
Santa comes around on a special night.
Special night. Beard that's white must be Santa.